The following message by Dr. Anthony Campolo was delivered at 3 o'clock on 3/21/1979 for the 1979 Staley Lecture Series held in Estes Chapel. The subject of this message is A Modern Sinner Looks at Christianity, Marx. The service was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of the service. Since ownership privileges must be observed, the seminary is requesting that you take personal responsibility to see that messages are not transcribed into manuscript form or other copies duplicated without the specific consent of the speaker.
Shall we bow our heads in prayer, please? Father, we were so very deeply challenged this morning by your word. Thank you so much for that word. Again this afternoon, we ask that you confront us where we're at. Help us not to be content to stay where we're at. Make us uncomfortable with the problems that we hear. Help us to be willing to be part of the solution. Father, give us the desire, the love to correct, to change the errors. Father, help us to be willing to be chastised by you. Thank you so much for loving us enough to chastise us. Father, just now I ask that you would take from our minds anything that would shut you out, anything that would take away from focusing on you, the pressures of midterm, friends sitting around, but help us to be willing to receive the very thing that you have to say to us. Thank you for your servant, Professor Campolo. Bless his ministry and help us to be used of you and to act on what we hear. We'll give you all the praise. Amen. Professor Campolo is chairman of the sociology department at Eastern College in St. David's, Pennsylvania, where he has taught since 1965. His major field of study is the family, and he's lectured on this and many other subjects throughout the United States. Professor Campolo is founder and president of a corporation involved in educational, economic, and medical programs in the Dominican Republic, Niger, and Haiti. He is the author of a book and numerous journal articles. A graduate of Eastern College and Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary, Professor Campolo received his PhD from Temple University. I know that you who attended the first lecture of this series this morning were as challenged as I was. Professor Campolo, we're very eagerly awaiting your challenge to us this afternoon. Professor Campolo.
It's good to be back and to see some familiar faces now that I've gotten to know some of you on campus. Familiar faces are not always a really good thing. I teach at two institutions. I'm an adjunct faculty member at the university, and I've been teaching at my first love, Eastern College, for many years. And I travel on a commuter train between the two locations. It's called the Paoli Local. If you know Philadelphia, you know the Paoli Local. And when I go to get the train in the morning, I usually go with umbrella in hand, and all goes well. Particularly because it's usually raining around our way. I have a tendency to leave my umbrellas at my office at the university. One day I got up and it was raining and I went out and got the train and sat down on the train and was reading my book. When I got to the 30th Street station, I instinctively reached down and picked up the umbrella of the elderly woman sitting on my right. She yelled at me, "Young man," which made my day. I looked back at her and I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "You have my umbrella." So I gave her back the umbrella and apologized in as profuse a manner as I could and went on about my business. When I finished my lecture for the day, I was walking out of the lecture hall and my secretary came up to me and handed me four umbrellas and said, "Your wife called and said, take home the umbrellas." So I put them under my arm and I got back on the Paoli Local and I was walking down the aisle of the train. You're right. She bumped into me, I bumped into her. She looked at me. She looked at my four umbrellas and she said, "You've had a pretty good day of it, haven't you?" So sometimes it is not always a delight to see a familiar face. This morning we talked about Durkheim, who I considered one of the cultured despisers of Christianity. And today we look at another cultured despiser of Christianity, and perhaps the one who has made the most serious impact on Christian theology. For in one way or another, over the past few years, Christian theology has either been reacting to this man's thought or expressing this man's thought. And of course, the man of which I speak is Karl Marx. As we talk about Karl Marx from a Christian perspective, I think that we must recognize that there are two people that we're dealing with here, even though they're all wrapped up in one person. The early Marx and the later Marx. It's the early Marx that intrigues me the most. For he was a man who interpreted the predicaments of human existence from the position of alienation. He saw alienation as the primary malady of the human system and situation. Later on, Marx would change his mind and interpret the problems of human beings from the perspective of exploitation. He saw all problems resulting from exploitation in the last part of his life. So that if you read Marx to any large degree, you'll find that the emphasis that he has in his early writings is far different from the emphasis that he has in his later writings, which is intriguing, because very often Marxians emerge in Russia who criticize what is going on in Russia. And a lot of us say, "Ah, they have rejected Marxianism." Oh no, what they are doing is judging negatively what is happening in Russia according to the perspective that is provided by the early Marxian writings. Well, one can use the early Marx as a criticism of what developed as a result of the later Marx. But let's get down to theology itself. Marx was intrigued with theology. One of his best friends was Feuerbach, the neo-Hegelian theologian. And his early writings almost completely focused on theology. First of all, he was intrigued with Calvinism. He was intrigued with Calvinism because Calvin gave the doctrine of total depravity, and he reacted against that very, very emphatically. He said, and I think that his thought is best expressed on Calvinism by one of his students, Eric Fromm. Fromm, in his book Escape from Freedom, has an excellent section on the Marxian critique of capitalism, or rather of Calvinism, which needs to be looked at in great depth. What Marx said was this, that religion is a process whereby people become alienated from their own natures. He said what theology does, what particularly Calvinistic theology does, is this, is it gets people to dichotomize their personalities, to extract from their personalities all that is good, and to assign all that is good in themselves to God, reserving all that is evil about themselves for themselves. Marx would argue that human beings are an ugly mixture of good and evil, but that religion gets us to see ourselves as totally evil and teaches us to extract from our personhood that which is good and assign that to God. In short, when we worship, we are worshiping ourselves, says Marx, but we are worshiping a particular part of ourselves. We are worshiping the best that is in us, the best that is in us, and we are reserving for ourselves the worst. Thus, God is good. We are completely corrupt. We are wretches, we are worms, we are totally despicable, we are totally evil. And thus he says, religion is a process whereby people become alienated from the good that is within them. For the good that is within them, they do not treat as though it was really their own. They act as though the good that was in them is really belonging to God. I hope you follow that concept of alienation, where people become alienated from their own good by assigning their own good to God and worshiping their own good as though their own good was incarnated in a deity that was totally separate from they themselves. And it's against this that he reacts violently. What's more is, he argues that this kind of teaching leads to a contempt for other human beings. Eric Fromm assigns this particular view to the origins of totalitarianism in Germany and in the Western culture. For he feels that only people who become convinced of their own total degradation, ever become fanatically committed to totalitarian movements. Eric Hoffer picks up the same theme in his book, The True Believer. But what they are saying is this: to give yourself away in a cause without reservation, to commit yourself to a movement and be willing to die for that movement, leaves you with the belief that you must not be worth anything, because only people who feel that they are not worth anything are willing to die, says Marx, for causes. I'm not convinced that that's true. The second thing that Marx would say in this whole process of alienation has to do with the issue of production. Here, I think his attack on theology is very pronounced and is very useful. And it's here that I, as a Christian, can most readily identify with Karl Marx. Marx says we have to understand alienation in its emotional nature. Let us begin to understand the second aspect of Marx, this emphasis of alienation in production in respect to nature itself, by starting with his analysis of primitive peoples. He said primitive peoples are not in a state of alienation. Primitive human beings, pre-literate people, pre-industrial types, have a sense of emotional empathy with the natural environments in which they live. To the primitive, his environment is surrounded by creatures that are alive with personhood. Trees, for instance, to the primitive mind, has a personality. Rocks have personality. Rivers have personality. Everything in nature is alive with personhood. Thus, in fact, primitives do not indiscriminately pollute rivers, because before they dump anything into a river, they ask a very simple question. I wonder how the river will feel about this. You say, but rivers don't feel. To the primitive, they do. They do have emotions. They do respond. Let's go beyond that. Before the primitive cuts down a tree, there is usually some kind of religious ceremony he goes through, because he wants the tree to understand the necessity of having to cut it down. The tree should understand and should feel what is being involved here. You say, trees don't feel, rocks don't feel, rivers don't feel. Ah, says Marx, that's what the primitive has over us. For the primitive man lives in a world that is surrounded by creatures that are alive with personhood. And the importance of that is this: that the way people interact with persons is very different than the way in which they interact with things. Personal interaction gives to individuals a sense of fulfillment and emotional ecstasy that raises them to their highest levels of humanization. To be surrounded by things, on the other hand, to treat trees and rivers as things, denies the individual of the kind of personal empathy that can humanize him. In short, primitives have a personal relationship with the elements of their physical environment that humanize them and lift them to a higher level of ecstasy than modern people do. Modern people, in fact, become strangers in their physical environment. Trees, rocks, rivers, all these things are things which give them no emotional empathy, give them, in fact, no emotional fulfillment. In fact, the primitive man enters into no feeling of emotional gratification with his physical environment. The problem with that is this: that it would be bad enough if we were alienated from trees and rocks and rivers. But Marx goes on to point out that that's only the beginning of the process. Little by little, this tendency to treat living things as things rather than as persons progresses to the point where we begin to treat other human beings as things. They become objects to be manipulated. Eric Fromm says it well. He says, in our age, we have things that act like machines. We have persons that act like machines and machines that act like persons. That in fact, we have made people into thing-like creatures to be manipulated. And we view people as things. Certainly, he would have criticized severely the psychology of a B.F. Skinner. For B.F. Skinner sees man basically as a thing, as a machine, without any spiritual dimension to him whatsoever. It was against this, strangely as it may seem, that Marx was reacting. The thingification of human beings, the treating of people as things, or as Martin Buber would call them, as its, is contrary to the whole style of the Marxian understanding of what a human being should be like. Ultimately, this process of alienation means that man is not only alienated from his physical environment, and he as a subject lives in a world of objects to which he cannot emotionally relate. He is not only surrounded by other people who become objects to which he as a subject cannot relate, but he begins to treat himself as an object and becomes alienated from the ground of his own being. It's here that Paul Tillich, picks up the teachings of Karl Marx to a high degree and understands that the state of sin is to be in a state of estrangement, which is another word for alienation from the ground of one's own being. That one not only treats trees as things, people as things, but one begins to see himself as a thing manipulated by external forces. It then goes beyond that. This whole feeling of alienation, this absence of ecstasy that is so much a part of modern man as he finds himself cut off from the emotional fulfillment that would come from nature, from the emotional fulfillment that would come from relationships, from the emotional fulfillment that would come from being in contact with the ground of his own being. All of this leaves him emotionally impoverished. It's from this position that he progresses to the industrial process. He says work itself has become alienating. It used to be that when people made things, what they made was an extension of their own personhood. I can understand that. My father was a cabinet maker for RCA, and he made cabinets back in the day when men made cabinets. Today, men don't make cabinets. They run the machines, and the machines make the cabinets. But my father was an artisan. He took wood, he sanded it, he smoothed it, he polished it, he stained it. He made radio cabinets. I can remember as a boy going visiting to friends and neighbors, and we would sit down, and my dad would say, look behind the radio, because these old big consoles that they used to make in those days were such that it left room for my father to carve his initials into the back of the radio so that I could go around in back of the radio to see whether it was one that he had made. And every once in a while, I would come across a cabinet that he had made, and I would say, it's one of yours, Dad. And I can still remember the joy, the excitement that would come when my dad would look at a radio box that he had made. For what he had made was not just a thing. The thing that he had made had somehow become an expression of his own personhood. In some way, he was mystically involved with a product of his own creation. If you have small children, you know of what I speak. My little boy comes home from school with a clay thing made by his own hands and it's painted green. And he offers it to me and I ask him the very obvious question. What is it? He tells me it's an elephant. Well, I'm not about to argue with this kid, right? It's an elephant. If he says it's an elephant, it's an elephant. So I take his elephant, and I put it on top of the refrigerator. As a sociologist, I have been intrigued with the functions of refrigerators in American homes. I mean, I am convinced that keeping food cool is only a secondary function. Its primary and latent function is that it becomes the place where all things are displayed. Notes are left on refrigerators. Pictures are pasted on refrigerators. Warnings are left on refrigerators. And on top of refrigerators, you put the things that people make. I don't know about you. In my house, we have little metal magnets that hold up the messages. Do they do that in your house, too? And so we put these things on top of the refrigerator. The next day, he comes home with another thing, and I put it there. And the next day, with another thing. But there is something about a boy making something. Remember when you were a kid in crafts at school or at Daily Vacation Bible School, when you would make something and you would bring it home and it was extra special, it was different than anything that you had ever made before, and you'd hold it up. And you know, mothers are suckers for things that you made. You can take an old stick that you found in the street, bring it home and hold it to your mother and say, for you, for me, you made this for me, you know, and she starts crying and it's very sickening. It makes you want to puke when you give something to your mother. But in fact, children bring home these things and the thing has an emotional meaning. It has an emotional significance for both the receiver and the giver that things that are manufactured do not possess. It's the craftsmanship that is involved that allows the craftsman to somehow psychologically and emotionally extend himself in the product of his own production that gives him the ecstasy that comes from true work. And so it is that there's fulfillment that comes from making something and allowing somehow the deepest feelings of your heart and life to be expressed in the product of your own creation. What Marx was concerned about was that the modern industrial process denies human beings the opportunity to find this kind of fulfillment in production. That basically, people do not feel at the end of a day when they work in an assembly line that they have made anything. I think the epitome of this was found in a friend of mine who bought a new Oldsmobile, and on his way home, there was a rattle in the door. So he went back to the dealer, and he said, there's a rattle in the door, so they removed the panel on the side of the door, and lo and behold, inside the door of this Oldsmobile were three long bolts and a note left here by Ralph Abelard. Now, you can almost get the picture, can't you? Poor Ralphie is working at the factory. Day after day, he's putting
panels on doors, and he has no sense of emotional empathy with what he's doing. In fact, he knows that if they fire him, they will go on making Oldsmobiles as though he never existed. He can never say at the end of a day, this is me. So one day, Ralphie goes down with a handful of bolts and starts throwing bolts into doors with little notes, reft here by Ralph Abelard. Can't you just imagine him going home that day, smiling and giggling to himself and saying, I may be fired tomorrow, but all across America, people will know that I exist. In reality, there is an attempt, says Marx, for people to try to leave their mark in the world through what they produce. All of us want to do something that in some way expresses who we are and what we are in a unique way. McGill and Amuno said, it is an innate drive that every person wants to render himself indispensable and do something that has never been done. That creative urge, to me, to a large degree, that creative urge is part of what it means to be in the image of God. For even as God is creator, all of his creatures likewise have this desire to be creative. And we can pick up on people on the assembly line, but increasingly, the major part of the American workforce is not on the assembly line. It's the white-collar segment of the population. And I think in the movie Joe, there was a very excellent scene where Joe the hard hat is standing next to this business executive as the executive points to the high-rise building where the executive works, and he says, Joe, do you know what we make there? Do you know what we do there? Do you know what we work at all day long? And Joe says, no, what do you guys do up there in that building? And this executive of this huge corporation says, we move paper. What a commentary. For in a sense, what is happening here is the man is getting no sense of fulfillment out of what he is doing. Paul Goodman, one of the modern American Marxian sociologists, picks up this theme in his book Growing Up Absurd and argues that 80% of the American workers hate what they're doing. You know, I have to say something here as just a byline to seminary types. Because everywhere I go, I meet seminary types who are saying, oh, the work of the ministry, it's so tough. Oh, it's so hard, and all of that jazz. My goodness gracious. Do you know what the rest of the world is up against? 80% of the population out there basically gets up in the morning and goes to jobs that they basically hate. Do you know that? Do you understand that kind of emptiness, that lack of fulfillment that comes from working 8 hours a day in something that gives you no sense of ecstasy, no sense of fulfillment, no sense of excitement? At the end of the day, you feel that you accomplished nothing. Never before have American people worked less and come home more tired. And that exhaustion comes not from physical exertion, but that tiredness comes from the absurdity of meaningless work, of work that gives to the worker no sense of aggrandizement. And when I look at young people and say they ought to consider full-time Christian service, you know, they always look back at me like, man, what a sacrifice. A sacrifice? What are the options? I mean, what really are the options? What's so great about not being committed to the work of Christ's kingdom in the full-time service? What's so great about it? To go to work and make a lot of money doing stuff that in fact gives you no sense of fulfillment and no sense of ecstasy and no sense of aliveness. The thing that amazes me is exactly what Karl Marx is talking about. That the average man at the end of a day comes home drained, emotionally and psychically drained from production that gives him no sense of fulfillment. Even the university where I teach. Man, I get on that elevator on Monday morning. It's filled with dead people. Did you ever get on an elevator on Monday morning? It's always filled with dead people. It scares me. I'm always afraid when the doors close because I have the feeling I'm in a common casket. I'm always relieved when the thing moves up. I've gotten so that just to break the deadness of the thing, I start playing games on elevators. I don't know whether you're one who plays games on elevators. I do all the time. I like to get on crowded elevators. One of the best things to do is get on a crowded elevator. Try this sometime. Society has socialized us to turn and face the door. Agreed? Right? Don't turn. I do it all the time. I love it. You get on a crowded elevator, everybody's standing there like, and you get on, and you don't turn. You just get on and stand there. And they're like here, and you're like there. And at that point, I put on my silliest smile. About halfway up to the second floor, I usually say, you're probably wondering why I called this meeting, aren't you? You know, that usually. Sometimes when I'm on an elevator all by myself, I sing. Do you ever do that? That's great. Going up to the 10th floor, and you're singing, be my love, and with your kisses and this yearning. Not the fifth floor, you know. The elevator stops, the doors open to pick up passengers, and when the doors open and you're singing, "Be My Love," and with the people that are waiting to get on the elevator, they never do. I'll tell you one that I love to do. It's going over the Walt Whitman Bridge into Jersey. It's an expensive thing. But every once in a while, when I'm really feeling generous, I always say to the toll taker, "I got a good friend in the car right behind me." And instead of giving him 60 cents, I give him $1.20. Say, "That's my best friend behind me," and I take off. I don't know who's in the car behind me, but it's worth 60 cents just to look in the rearview mirror and watch the toll taker trying to explain it to the next car, I say. And people say to me, "What's this got to do with Christianity?" Why, it's got everything to do with Christianity. Marx perhaps understood Christianity more than those of us who go by his name. "You," says the scripture in the 8th chapter of Romans, "who used to be dead in trespasses of sin." The worst part of Satan's work is not that we go to hell in the sweet by and by. The worst part of the demonic is that it creates a demonic deadness in people here and now. And to sense that deadness is to see the work of evil. What in fact Marx should have been made to know by the church was this: that when people come out of work at the end of a day, drained of all enthusiasm, all excitement, when they become experienced spiritually and emotionally dead by their jobs, they are in fact experiencing the consequences of the demonic. That's the consequences of sin. God never wanted anybody to spend his life in absurdity. I don't know where God wants you to be, but I know where God doesn't want you to be. He doesn't want you to be in any position 8 hours a day where your humanity is negated, where your humanness is dissipated, where in fact you are so drained of psychic and emotional feelings that you come out almost zombie-like. And indeed, this became the great problem for Marx. He saw what the system of industrial production was doing to people. It was dehumanizing them. It was leaving them, in the words of T.S. Eliot, as hollow men, as empty men, as straw men blown to and fro by the wind. It was the emptiness of men that alarmed Marx, and he saw that the problem was highly related to their economic vocations. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that Marx does not have the final word, nor the final analysis as to what causes emotional and psychic deadness. But I do say that he has something important to say to us. A friend of mine graduated from the University of Pennsylvania when I did, with my master's. He went on to teach at Trenton State College. After 3 weeks of teaching, he came in one day and said to the dean, "I'm not coming back tomorrow, and I thought you ought to know." Well, you don't walk out in the middle of the semester, right? You don't do that kind of thing. Deans and presidents can become very mean when you want to walk out in the middle of a semester. And the dean said, "You quit. You're not going to teach here. You're not going to teach anywhere ever again." My friend walked out. His mother called me on the phone and said, "You've got to go and talk to Charlie. He's quit his job. He's crazy." So I went and hunted him up. Living in Hamilton Square, New Jersey, he was living in this little attic apartment. The minute I walked in, I was eating my heart out. He had, you know, posters on the walls and the stereo and the books all over the place. And he said, "Sit down." And I sat down in one of these beanbag chairs, you know, and immediately disappeared, you know. I looked across at him, and he had this silly grin on his face. I said, "Charlie, what have you done?" He said, "I quit." I said, "You can't quit. You're a PhD in English Lit." He said, "I can't teach." He said, "Every time I walk into that class, I die a little bit." Well, I understand that. I'm a teacher. I know what it's like to walk into class, to pour your heart out, to let every nerve, every sinew tingle with the excitement of what is ultimately important to you, to share the insight that it took you a lifetime of sorrow to grasp. And after you poured out your heart and soul, after you bled and cried and died for the students, some kid in the last row raises his hand and says, "Do we have to know this for the final?" And if you're a teacher, what happens? You die a little bit. I tried my hardest to convince this guy that he ought to get back into what he was trained to do. Finally, I realized he wasn't going to do it. I said, "Well, what are you doing with yourself?" He said, "I'm a mailman." And then the old Protestant ethic took over. "Are you ready for this?" "Well, Charlie," I said, "the important thing is not what you do. but how you do it. And if you're a mailman, it's important that you be the best mailman in the world. Ever heard that line before? He smiled back at me with his guru-like smile, and he said, I am a lousy mailman. I said, what do you mean? He said, everybody else gets the mail delivered by 1 o'clock. He said, I never get back to the post office till about 6. I said, what takes you so long? He said, I visit. I said, you visit. He said, you wouldn't believe how many people on my route never got visited till I got to be the mailman. He said, and a lot of them are really interested in English literature, not like my students. He said, I can't sleep at night. I said, what do you mean you can't sleep? He said, have you ever tried to sleep on 20 cups of coffee? And I began to see what it was all about. That here was a guy who, so far as society is concerned, had stepped down a notch, hadn't he? But who somehow had moved into an activity that gave him a sense of fulfillment, so that at the end of a day, he felt that he had invested himself in a meaningful way, that what he had done that day had significance and power. And that was the overcoming of alienation. In short, when Charlie came home at the end of a day, he may not have come home with prestige, he may not have come home with wealth, but when Charlie came home at the end of the day, he came home alive, fully alive. And that's what Marx was concerned about. And I contend that that's what Christianity should be concerned about. Martin Heidegger, I think, made this criticism of Christianity, which I think is valid. He said, Christianity puts such an emphasis on the afterlife that it fails to see the ultimate importance of life here and now. Indeed, that's true. When I was growing up, I was always told that this life was the meaningless passage of time, a brief testing period. The real period of human existence came after you died. In the sweet by and by, it was all going to be up there. A billion years of endless time. You know, it goes on and on and on of all of this life. So what difference does this life make? This life is meaningless compared with eternity. Well, this life is not meaningless. This life has ultimate significance. And Jesus Christ came into the world not simply to give you pie in the sky when you die, but Jesus came into the world in order that we might have life and have it more abundantly. And if in fact our lives do not radiate an abundance, if in fact at the end of a day we are not filled with ecstasy and aliveness, we have in fact been living sinfully. To be sinful, says Tillich, is to live in a state of estrangement, to live in that sense of lack of fulfillment so that you have nothing to give to other people. Let me say this about marriage. Marx once says something very profound on marriage that I want to repeat to you. He said, the only people that ought to get married are people that don't have to. Brilliant. What he was saying was too many people come to marriage as empty, hollow people with no sense of fulfillment, and they think they're going to find in a marital relationship all the fulfillment that they lack. And what they do is ultimately place demands on the other person until they exhaust the other person emotionally, saying, give, 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 I'm empty, fill me up, fill me up, fill me up. And after they've made all the demands, the individual finds himself empty and devoid of any ecstasy in spite of all that the wife or the husband has given. Because the individual becomes virtually a bottomless pit and cannot be filled. We should not come to one another empty, demanding that the other fill us. But we should come to one another, says Marx, as people who are ecstatically alive, who are flowing over into each other's lives. Or to use biblical terminology, we should be like fountains of living water, bubbling over. In fact, I really believe that Jesus calls us to a lifestyle of ecstasy, a lifestyle of meaning. Work at the end of a day should leave the individual in a state of aliveness, not in a state of deadness. And it was this that Marx concerned himself about, that work was leaving people in a state of deadness instead of in a state of an aliveness. And he felt that we had to do something to change the whole industrial process to overcome the alienation where people feel so cut off from the labors of their own production that they have no sense of fulfillment in what they do. I think that one of the things that the church ought to be doing to people is to help a lot of them to dream. Too many times, people are unhappy in what they're doing, and their emptiness at work spills over into empty marriages, and they wreck their children because their children give them no ecstasy, and they give no ecstasy to their children. And I say it's time that we challenge people to realize that maybe they aren't where they ought to be, no matter how well it pays. People say to me, are you suggesting that the minister stands up and says to the person who is unfulfilled in his work that he should quit? Well, he can't starve to death. Not in America. The Democrats are in. Fact is,
that life is more than bread and man shall not live by bread alone. And I think that's an important thrust. One doesn't have to agree with all of Marx, but please understand his concern, because if you don't understand his concern, you won't understand why Marxianism has such a vibrant attraction to so many young intellectuals all across this country and around the world. They see that here's a man that is concerned about what happens to people emotionally and psychically, and how human dehumanized they can become in the industrial processes of our contemporary society. And I think that the church has ignored that to a large degree and has only been concerned about getting people to repent of drinking, smoking, and dancing, not realizing that, in fact, people often have to drink and smoke and take drugs simply to escape the futility of meaningless existence. There's another thing that Marx saw that Herbert Marcuse, one of his modern interpreters, has seen even better and as perhaps even more applicable to our contemporary society. Not only are we alienated in the process of production, but we are alienated, says Marx, in the process of consumption, in what we consume, what we buy. You see, the American economy, he predicted, and he was brilliant in his prediction of the American economy. He said the American economy would reach such a high level of effectiveness that the only way in which it could survive would be the following: to get people to buy what they don't need. That's the only way it will survive. Because the production process is so efficient that it produces everything that we need with very little labor. Therefore, to keep everybody employed, we have to produce a lot of stuff we don't need. And in order to get people to buy what they don't need, they will have to be manipulated, and he predicted Madison Avenue, they would have to be manipulated into buying stuff that they basically don't need. The intriguing thing is that Marcuse and Jules Henry see this in even more brilliant dimensions. The way that our society gets people to buy what they don't need is by convincing them that the things that they buy will satisfy deep spiritual and emotional needs. For instance, one of my favorite ads is one where a Buick comes driving up on a beach. Excuse me, it's a Dodge comes driving up on a beach, and there's a homely-looking guy and a homely-looking girl sitting there, and the guy is about to ask the girl to marry him, when suddenly up to the car come these three gorgeous women from Asbury. I had to be relevant there, you know. And so, you know, they came up to the car, and they say, "Take us for a ride." And they get in the car, and the homely-looking one is shoved out, and the car goes driving off the beach, and a little Dodge girl arrives, and she smiles and looks at the audience and says, "Did you see that, fellas? Maybe you should buy a Dodge if you need a whole new image." Beautiful. Beautiful. What is for sale for $8,000? A car? Oh, no. For $8,000, they're going to give you far more than a car. They promise to deliver what? A new image. Now, Jay, you know, you may not need a new car, but as I look at you this morning, it just may be that you may need and may I say, this exploitation reaches its highest degree with the blacks in the ghetto. For he's manipulated by the same media that manipulates you. And he goes out and takes his welfare checks and buys a car, and the whole society says, "I don't mind welfare, but when they start spending welfare checks for new cars, I get upset." But maybe a new image, which is what the guy is really trying to get, is more important to him than food. Maybe a new self-image is more important than bread, more important than clothes. The only problem is that he doesn't get a new image. I think that image is important, but I contend that one can only achieve a new image by a redefinition in Jesus Christ. And when the media promises that you can get this from an automobile, it deceives you. You're being manipulated in your consumer processes. Let's go a step further. Buicks, as the ad goes, is something you can believe in. You thought it was an automobile, it's a religious conviction. Datsun saves. Or maybe you would like a new Pentecostal experience, because I understand that Asbury's big on revivals. Well, here's the good word. Listen to this. The ad starts with all humanity gathered on a hill, black, white, people from Afghanistan, India, Europe, all kinds of people, all kinds of races, and they're holding hands. Certainly Babel has been overcome. Going to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And what is it that has brought perfect harmony to broken humanity? It's what? Coca-Cola. There's a new ad for Levi's that I really, really love. It starts off, listen to this. It starts off with this. It starts off with a voice in the background saying, "We were all living in darkness until he came. And he brought to us light.
He gave us plaids, and they show a guy light up in plaids. Stripes, they show a guy light up in stripes. Checks, and they show another guy light up in checks. And the ad goes on to say, he brought joy to our lives. And we pled with him to stay with us. But he said no, he had to go on. There were other towns that needed him. And so he left. But when he left, he promised that one day he would come back. Now, friends, you may call that legitimate capitalism. I call it blasphemy. And we're being manipulated by a media into buying a lot of stuff that we don't need because, in fact, we are convinced that these things will gratify our need for a Messiah, our need for salvation, our need for a new image, our need for freedom. Just think of all the ads. We have a beer ad. You tell the world you know what you're doing every time you reach for Schlitz. Come on, most of the guys that I know that reach for Schlitz are trying to forget what they're doing. The last honest ad, and you'd have to be old enough to remember this. The last honest ad that I remember. Do you remember the old Lifebuoy ad? Do you remember that one? They didn't promise you freedom, salvation, a new being. And all they promised the old Lifebuoy ad was they came on and said, Lifebuoy gets rid of, and with a foghorn they'd go, B-O. That was it. But what Marx and Marcuse are saying is that basically we are being manipulated into craving these things that we really don't need, believing that these things will gratify our deepest spiritual psychological needs. And here's the irony, that even as we crave these things that society has gotten us to crave, our deepest psychological and emotional needs go unmet. So never before have we had more and been less gratified, because the ads stimulate our hunger for things that things cannot in fact provide. It's the trickery of our age. So that our age ends up spending vast amounts of money buying stuff that we think we need, because human beings have become alienated from their real needs. They don't even know. This is what alienation means. You're so cut off from who you really are that you don't even know what you really need. The media has got you thinking that you need what the system is producing. That's alienation. When what the system produces is more necessary to you than the things of the Spirit, then in fact you are ultimately alienated. I say that Marx is closer to New Testament preaching than most ministers that I've heard. Why do you long for those things which satisfieth not? Why do you spend your money for those things that do not give you gratification? It's a big question. I know this in my own life. Christmas time comes. I get no problem about buying presents. My big problem is what? That when I go down to the store, my biggest problem is trying to figure out what to buy for a family that basically what? Has everything. But thank God, through the initiative of modern technology, they are always inventing some weird thing that nobody needs that I can buy at Christmas time. And I go out there and I spend $150 and bring the stuff home. And my kids and my wife open the presents on Christmas morning and they always say, oh, wow, it's really nice. What is it? And all of this would be humorous except for one thing. While we are buying stuff that we think we need at a rate that staggers the imagination, most of the third world has their basic physical human needs going unmet. And God is not mocked. A system that so structures itself to get people to spend vast amounts of wealth on stuff that nobody needs while human needs are being ignored over here is a system that ultimately is condemned of God. Marx never confronted a God who is angry with a society that consumed vast resources producing stuff that nobody needed. He never was confronted with that God. The God that he met in church was not the God that in fact we're talking about here, who grows angry with a system that overconsumes in the midst of desperate needs in another location. And thus I say that Marxian critique is perhaps an exciting critique to see indeed. The last two things that I will deal with are these. Ideology. Marx said that our thinking tends to be alienated. He didn't believe in ideas. He believed in ideologies. The difference between ideologies and ideas are these. Ideologies are systems of thought which are invented to justify the vested interest of some group. Every group invents. Good example. I was a guest lecturer at Autonoma University in Santo Domingo. The school is slightly to the left of Mao. I mean, to say it's leftist is an understatement. And as I'm walking down to speak in Che Guevara Hall, which gives you some ideas to the complexion of the institution, the head of the student body, who is extremely leftist, confronts me and says, I want to know whether your biological theories, because he assumes that sociology is built on biological assumptions, and that's not a bad assumption. I said, he wanted to know whether my biological assumptions about human beings and about social reality were communistic or capitalistic. That blew my mind. I said, what do you mean, capitalistic biology, socialistic biology? Biology is biology. He says, oh, no. He said, in capitalistic countries, you study evolution. And evolution is the story of how all progress is built on what? On the struggle for survival. That there are a limited number of creatures. There's a number of creatures competing for limited resources, and in the struggle to survive, the strongest survive, the unfit die off, and hence the strongest and the superior members of the species reproduce, thus continually improving the species, and thus you have evolutionary development upwards. You know that. He says, but don't you see that that model of evolution is really a capitalistic model? It's all about capitalism and about competition, and it says that all progress is related to competition. I said, that's terrific. But what do you guys say? He said, well, in a socialistic society, we say that all evolution is dependent on cooperation. That the lowest form of life is an amoeba. It's a singular creature that doesn't cooperate with anybody. But as we move up the phylogenetic scale, we see cellular units coming together and forming cooperative units. And the higher the level of cooperation, the higher the level of social development, until we get to human beings, which are billions of cells working together as one unified group. Do you see the difference between the lowest form of life and the highest form of life is cooperation? The more the cooperation, the higher the level of development. Well, you know, that's a logical explanation, isn't it? Which, of course, raises the whole question about evolution itself. And I looked at him and I said, Which explanation of evolution is true? Come on now. He said, it's not a matter of truth, Dr. Campolo. It's a matter of which interpretation of evolution best serves the economic political system. Do you see that? Now let me just point out that we use a lot of religion to justify political and economic systems. There's a lot of oppression of women in today's society. It's easy to use what? Religion to justify oppression. It was easy to use religion to justify established systems. The whole concept of ideology is at work here. The reason why I bring this up is because liberation theology has picked up this theme. Liberation theology, particularly in James Cone's version, says the following. Each social class develops a system of thought that serves its vested interest. Therefore, the theology generated by the middle class, says James Cone, is a theology that basically legitimates the middle class and serves the vested interest of the middle class. Whereas the socially oppressed, the proletariat, the beaten people of the world, they will develop a different theology, and it will be a theology that serves their interest. And then James Cone says the following. He says, but in the struggle between the classes, Jesus does not ally with the bourgeoisie. Instead, he allies with the proletariat. Therefore, the only valid ideology, or consequently only valid theology, is the theology of the socially oppressed. And you may probably have begun to read the liberation theology of James Cone, in which he points out that Jesus needs to be interpreted basically as a liberator. Right? He is one who champions the cause of the oppressed against the oppressors, and they go through the entire Old Testament and the New Testament, and they give an interpretation of Jesus, an interpretation of God that really makes God and really makes Jesus into a champion of the proletariat even more than Lenin was. You say, is that legitimate? Marx says it certainly is. I'm not so sure. I think that we do harm if we make Jesus into a legitimator of the social system. I think we also do harm if we want to make Jesus into a proletarian revolutionary. I think that it becomes dangerous to define God anyway. I think that what we really need to do is constantly struggle with the question and realize that any conceptualization that we come up with may, in fact, be more a revelation of what we are than what God is. The last thing that I want to share with this, that Marx said that finally, people looked at the system in which they lived and didn't believe that they could change it. They were ultimately alienated from the social system which they themselves created. This is why he called religion the opiate of the people. It said to people, don't try to change society. Society can't be changed. And so the blacks were told not to attack slavery. So people who were oppressed were told not to question their oppression. because of the sweet by and by they would be rewarded. Life in the sky by and by would be sufficient compensation for enduring the absurdities of life in meaningless, absurd positions in time and space. By promising people a better life up there, they would be willing to endure a meaningless and absurd life here. And Marx reacted against that because he said any religion that keeps people from attacking the injustices of their own day is a religion that has to be evil in its final essence. I contend that Marx was right. I don't think Jesus ever meant religion to be something that so focused our attention on the next world that we ignored the injustices of this world, and I think that Jesus calls us to participate with him and what he is doing in history to correct the great injustices of our time. People say to me, but can the system be changed? And nobody is worse than ministers for being cynical about changing the system. Get involved in the church because you can't change the world. Well, you can change the world. It's about time that the church realizes what it really is. It is the greatest power in time and history. You say greater than the power of Jesus? It is the power of Jesus. He said to us, all power is given unto you, both in heaven and earth. And we have a right to challenge the systems of our day. In our own town, Philadelphia, I remember when we challenged the hiring systems of Tasty Cake, one of the big corporations in our town. They weren't hiring blacks some 20 years ago, so we challenged them. A group of us went down there and we asked if they would hire some of the black people from our church, and they said, well, they didn't have room, and they didn't want to create tensions, and they went through all the excuses. And the man told us not to be concerned about his prejudice. He wasn't prejudiced. Some of his best friends are black. I remember we went back at a ministerial meeting of the black ministerial. I belong to the black ministerial because our church is a black church. And I remember Leon Sullivan saying to the group, if black people won't eat, it won't be hired by Tasty Cake. If Tasty Cake won't hire black people, then black people won't eat Tasty Cakes. I raised my hand and I said, Dr. Sullivan, that sounds like an economic boycott. He said, let us call it selective buying. It does have a better ring to it, doesn't it? I didn't think it would work, but then I didn't know how many Tasty Cakes black people eat. They were eating approximately 30,000 Tasty Cakes a day in Philadelphia. That was on Friday. The word went out on Sunday. Monday morning, black people only ate 3,000 Tasty Cakes. When sales in a corporation drop by 27,000 in one day, the spirit moves. And they called and said that they would hire blacks. And they had 20 openings. I said, that's funny. We got over 35 people that need jobs. I mean, if you got them, get them. We began to work on things like that. We began to see that the Church of Jesus Christ could challenge injustice and could, in fact, in a nonviolent way, call the system into accountability. You say, do you really believe that you can create the kingdom of God? Of course not. That's what the second coming is all about. But the fact that Jesus brings to completion something at the second coming doesn't mean that we shouldn't begin it here and now. The Bible says that the good work which he begins in us, he will complete at the day of his coming. And we got to be at work here and now, attacking the systems, not because we're going to create perfection, but because our very attack in social injustice is a testimony of the kind of God we worship, gives testimony of the kind of Lord that we adhere to, a God that hates injustice. A God that hates the oppression. You say, can you change anything? We can change it all in the end, because that's what the second coming is all about. Let me conclude on this story. It's one that I use all across the country because it's my favorite story. My home church has a preaching service once a year. It's a good service. Get about 8 preachers and we preach back to back. It's not like a white church. White churches are rotten at preaching. I mean, in a white church, you can say almost anything and you get one reaction. Black church, the deacons sit right up front, right up front. And every time you say something good, the deacons yell, preach! Preach! Boy, that makes you want to go, man. The women out there in the congregation, they're much more polite. They don't yell preach. Whenever you say something really good, the women go like this. They go, well, just like that. Well, oh. When they do that, when they give you a well, that just runs chills up and down my back. No question about it. The men out there, when they get turned on, you know, in the sermon, they don't yell, preach it or well. They yell, keep God! Keep God! Now, you don't get that in a white church. White church, you get, stop! Stop! So it was my turn to preach, and I got up. There were about 8 of us that were going to preach this day. It was going to be a religious Woodstock. And I got up there, I got up there and I started preaching. And I want to tell you, people, I was good. And the better I got, the better they got. And the better they got, the better I got. I got better and better and better. I got so good, I wanted to take notes on me. Have you ever done that? I came to the end of the message. I felt great. I sat down. I thought that place was going to come down. Sat down, the pastor looked at me, nudged me, said, "You did all right, boy." I hate it when he calls me boy. And I said to him, I said, "Pastor," he said, "Yeah." I said, you think you can top that? He said, son, he said, "Just you sit back and you watch." And he got up, and for the next hour, he blew that place apart with one line. Here I go to seminary, go to graduate school to get all these deep insights, and this guy gets up with one line. Here was the line. "It's Friday, but Sunday's coming." That's not overpowering. You should have heard him do it. Started nice and soft. "It's Friday. Friday, and Jesus is on the cross. And everything's dark. But that's because it's Friday. Sunday's coming." Somebody yells, "Right on!" And he started. "It's Friday. Friday, Mary is crying her eyes out. Because her baby boy is dead. But that's because it's Friday. Sunday's coming. Preach, right?" It's Friday. Friday, and those forces that oppress the poor and make the poor to cry, that leave the poor battered and beaten, them forces are in control. But that's because it's Friday. Sun is a-coming. And they pick it up, you know. Keep going, preach, keep going. And they're picking up. It's Friday. Can't you just hear him? It's Friday. Pilate's washing his hands, and the political establishment seems to be in control and seems to be saying, "As things have been, so they shall be." But that's because it's Friday. Sun's coming. Doesn't that run chills up your back? I mean, doesn't it really? I thought I would get something out of you by this time, you know. Let's try it one more time. One more time, just your last chance now. It's Friday. Friday, the disciples are running in every direction, and they see no hope for history. They see no hope for the world. Nothing can be changed. That's because it's Friday. Sunday's a-coming. Yeah, right. Well, he went on like that just for 3/4 of an hour, just over and over again, one line. It's Friday, Sunday's coming, Friday, Sunday's coming, Friday, Sunday's coming, Friday, Sunday's coming. He came to the end of that message. He didn't even have to preach. He just yelled at the top of his lungs, "Friday!" And all 1,500 of us in that church shouted back with one voice, "Sunday's a-coming!" Hey, gang, that's what Marx never saw in a church. He never saw a group of people who felt that they could take on the world and lick it. He never saw a group of people who would challenge the injustices and the oppressions of his age. He never saw that. But we're the people that have to echo far and loud and far and near the good word. And the good word that we have for those who don't believe that the church can be the power of history, moving towards the eschaton, we are the ones who have to shout it over and over again. It's Friday!